Sorry about that. That's the way to hold a room. So if you're wondering what happened, the newfangled PowerPoint punts the screen sharing with Illuminate. So as soon as I turned on my slideshow, it punted the sharing out. And so I don't know what the people on Illuminate saw, but it wasn't me. So I'm your Noon Hour Entertainment. I've got juggling pins, bowling balls, and a donkey in the hall. But first I'm going to do this talk. I am talking into the mic. All right. Is that better? Yeah. Unfortunate they haven't hosted many conferences in this hotel and don't know to put speakers near the back of the room. Sorry, that was sarcasm. Thanks, George, for the historical introduction. I appreciated that. I was thinking about the history a bit before I began my talk, and did some looking up, and it's almost 10 years to the day that I launched the email version of OL Daily. When I was thinking about my history as compared with Martin WMS's history, and we've been messing around with the same sort of stuff around the same period of time. I started back in the 1990s with online bulletin board systems and then moved to the internet and multi-user domains with MUDs, and a bunch of colleagues and I set up something called the Painted Porch MUD for multi-academic user domain because people wouldn't fund multi-user dungeons. I also launched my first web resource around that time, the thing that I am actually most well known for, Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies. Have fun with this, aren't we? At Assiniboine Community College, we put up some online courses, certificate in adult education. I posted the document that George referred to, Future of Online Learning. And while I was at Assiniboine, I built a learning management system. I built it in Perl, so it did not become popular like Moodle. It was called Online Learning Environment, OLE, and we used that at the college to deliver quite a number of courses, college courses, general business certificate, high school courses, and a bunch of other stuff. And that kind of became my base application. I integrated it with RSS and built a community website, the Brandon pages out of it.
Can't see it at all in the back, so just go.
Go full screen, forget Illuminate. I'm sorry, Illuminate people. I didn't do this. Why don't you... Well, you can't. Okay. The note says go full screen, forget Illuminate.
Okay, I will broadcast off the webcam to them.
That's probably the way to go. Play from current slide. So, bye, Illuminate people. Now what's going to do? This is a case of software doing too much for you. Because it splits it, and there's a presenter screen here with my notes, and I never have notes because I never have a presenter screen, and I honestly don't know how to move the slides forward, but I'll try. Anyhow, I moved to the University of Alberta, and using this learning management system software that I built at Assiniboine built a knowledge, learning, and resources portal with Terry Anderson called Munimol. And we also built, using similar systems, something called Pegasus. It was an online course portal for petroleum engineers, geologists, and geophysicists. And around that time, I launched OL Daily and the Learning Marketplace. When I joined NRC in 2001, started working with a national consortium of education providers called EduSource. The intention was to create a marketplace of courses and learning resources that people could contribute to and share. So, Martin, I wish you the best of luck with Mooch. It has a long history of interesting effects. In 2003, my cat died. I know. But I dedicated EduRSS to her. EduRSS was a system that aggregated these learning resources into a single portal, organized them by topic, and then made them available by subscription to RSS. I used the same mechanism to do some early work in podcasting, and I did it a bit differently. I aggregated RSS feeds, grabbed the MP3 recordings out of them, and then created a SMILE file, a standard multimedia integration language file, which people could then play on their media player, and created something called Ed Radio, which had no listeners. I got involved in blogging and educational blogging. I wrote an article in Edutaz Review. I invented e-learning 2.0, which is the logical combination of web 2.0 with e-learning. It wasn't that big an invention. And around that time, you can see the famous personal learning environment diagram. Got involved in that area of thing. I did some early work in personal learning environments, including a thing called RSS Writer, which took the idea of EduRSS and combined it with the text editor. I also did work on something called MIDM, which is a distributed identification system. The idea is that your browser would log you in. It would log you in with an ID based on your home URL. So your URL would become your identity. And that became, out in the real world, something called OpenID. And now we have OAuth and OAuth 2. And I began to develop the concept of learning networks. Around 2008, I built and released an open source application, which has no users, called Grasshopper. I release lots of stuff open source, but I have very small open source communities. At NRC, I worked on a course development system called Synergique, which we did with Desire to Learn. Also with George, who was my happy introductor, we launched something called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, an online course that we thought would have about, 25 people, George? And we had something, and so it was going to be an open online course. We got 2,200 people signed up, and it became a massive open online course. And this led to the development of the idea of MOOCs. We ran a number of other courses. Two more instances of Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, a thing called Plank, George named it, and a thing called Critical Literacies. And that's kind of where we sit today. So I've followed the same sort of thread, but I haven't been dedicated to a single application. I've been rather much more dedicated over all of this time to the idea of networks, the idea of distributed resources, the idea of communications infrastructures. I've been focused on the internet as a whole rather than on a particular application within the internet. Through that time, I've been led to develop work on three major themes. The one we've already talked about, we talked about it yesterday morning, that was half my talk, so I had to rewrite it, open learning. The second, and I'll talk about that a bit today, connectivism, and then the main content of my talk today is to talk about the personal learning environment, or what comes after Moodle. Now, I know this is probably the wrong crowd to talk to about what comes after Moodle, and I understand that. What my intention here to do is to challenge you. I was going to put up a slide with horses in a horse race and then say, I don't have a horse in the race. I really don't have a horse in the race. I release open source software, it gets zero users. That's cool. I don't mind. I have a radio station. It's broadcasting right now. Nobody's listening to it. That's all right. The main point is, I can. It's almost the theme of the internet. You know, why do you have a cat picture? Because I can. Why are you broadcasting images of your cat around the world? Well, because I can. Anyhow, okay. So the idea of open learning, we looked at quite a bit about the idea of open learning. I don't want to linger on it a whole lot except to observe that it has a long history. Open learning predates me. It predates all of us pretty much. And with any luck, it will post-date us as well. Open learning influences almost everything that I do and much of what we do online. As I mentioned yesterday, Sir John Daniel, quoting James Taylor, talked about the different phases of open learning. And it's these different phases that have informed much of the technological work that I've done and that George has done and others with us have done over the years. The phases, for those of you who don't recall them, open educational resources is the first phase. The next phase is open courses or open course delivery. We could insert a phase here about open course design, open pedagogy, open course patterns, etc. Where we've tried to go next is open assessments, and then finally, the place where the universities dare not go, open credentialing. But there's also connectivism, and connectivism either is or is not a theory, and it doesn't really matter. But it's essentially, it's the thesis that knowledge is formed through the creation of connections. And that's a really hard one to get at, because what it means, it means different things at different times. It means if we're talking about a social environment, knowledge is created through the connections in that social environment. It means if we're talking about brains, it means that knowledge is created through the connections between neurons. If we're talking about crickets, it means that the knowledge represented by a body of crickets is created through the interaction of those crickets, and so on. What does it mean in practice? Well, what it means in practice is we don't focus almost at all on the curriculum. In the connectivist courses that George and I and others have offered, there is literally no curriculum. There's no body of knowledge that we want people to ingest and later on regurgitate. Maybe not the right language for lunchtime, is it? There's not to say there is no curriculum. It's more accurate to say that the curriculum, the course content, is the MacGuffin. And the idea of the MacGuffin is the object that everybody talks about, that everybody seeks, that everybody wants, but isn't really what the story is about. In the Maltese Falcon, the falcon is the MacGuffin. But the movie The Maltese Falcon isn't the story of a falcon. And it could be anything else, and it would have worked just as well. It could have been the Maltese donkey, miniature donkey, because otherwise Humphrey Bogart couldn't hold it in his hands. The product of a connectivist course or a connectivist environment is not the knowledge learned, but rather the learner. The idea here is that the learner is forming connections in their mind. The learner is growing. And it's not that there's nothing to learn. It's that you can't take it, flake it, form it, put it into words, and shove it at the learner and expect them to acquire the knowledge that you're looking them to acquire. Rather, the knowledge, the base of knowledge that you want them to learn, whether it be how to fly an airplane, whether it be how to do physics, whether it be how to write software, is complex, constantly changing, and needs to be navigated rather than memorized. And so what you're after is this intuitive sense of navigation of a domain rather than memory of the content in that domain. It leads to a philosophy and idea of learning as immersion. And I know that this is a philosophy and idea that many of you, through different approaches and through different methodologies, probably also accept. This here is a picture of people learning about robots. I listened to an excellent NPR program talking about children and robot competitions, and the report, I linked to it in my newsletter just a few days ago, so if you look at the archives, you can find this. And the interviewer is talking to these kids, and it's interesting because how to build and fight robots, actually they didn't fight, they did things like pick things up and move them, put them anyhow. I like the robot fights better, personally. But it wasn't about learning how to do this. So there was one kid was, you know, I want to be a marine biologist, and this is helping me. And you sort of scratch your head. But, you know, it's problem solving, it's teamwork, it's getting this feel for how to work with circuits, how to code software on the fly, all of that sort of thing. It's the sort of idea that Papert had, and then, of course, Nicholas Negroponte and others involved in the One Laptop Per Child project had when they introduced that program, the idea of giving children an environment, an unstructured and uncontrolled environment, where they could learn about whatever through immersion in that environment and participation in an ad hoc local network. It's learning by constructing things, learning by sharing things, learning by creating, producing, adapting, filtering, finding, and most of all, communicating with other people. So we have sort of informally, in connectivism, adopted a connectivist methodology. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. And each of those is an essential step in the learning process. Not all of those is emphasized equally. Aggregate is one that is very commonly overlooked, because most people in a learning environment have their content delivered to them. Here's what you will learn. Even when it's just a MacGuffin, it's delivered to them. Come here, here's the content. But finding what you need, selecting what you need from a large body of materials, localizing it, contextualizing it, all of these are important components to what it is to be a physicist or be a computer scientist or be a geologist. I mean, the first thing about being a geologist is recognizing that this is an interesting rock, this is just slate. So we have the idea of the personal learning environment, and yes, I will show that diagram, and I know there's skepticism sometimes about that diagram, but the whole point of this diagram is to show the environment in which those four processes of aggregation, remix, repurpose take place. I forgot feed forward too. So you have what Scott Wilson calls future VLE. That's the personal learning environment. But most of what happens, you notice it's just a circle, and there's really not a whole lot else there. Most of what is happening really is taking place in remote locations. Your system isn't doing all of your work for you. Your system is the mechanism that you use in order to communicate with other people on the internet, with other services, other resources, and for that matter, your own services and your own resources. So I mentioned some of the work that I've done over the years in developing this sort of approach to software, one of which was MyGlue. And it's a very simple, it's an incredibly ridiculously simple technology. Any of you could probably code it better than I could. Take a few RSS feeds as defined by an OPML file. For those of you who don't know, OPML stands for Outline Processor Markup Language, and it's just a fancy list of RSS feeds. Bring those RSS feeds in, join them together to create a mega RSS feed, filter the contents of that feed. I use topics, which are basically predefined regular expression searches, because it was easy, it was a one-liner to do my filtering, and then send the output out as a new RSS feed. Simple. And that's the basis to the connectivism courses that we've been offering. That technology really is what creates our courses. Well, that technology, and then George and I messing around with Illuminate and other stuff. So we've created these connectivist courses by trying to link together different resources, different technologies, different sources of information. Here's a diagram of the first connectivist course that we did. This is an actual course diagram, and you should notice that it looks rather different than your typical course with course structures and modules and things like that. We did actually use Moodle in that course. You can see the Moodle that we used. It's up in the left-hand top. It's the only bit with square bits in the entire course. All of that is, it's different services, different resources, feeds, etc., all connected to each other. So our core structure is the connection of a whole pile of resources. And then what we do is we take this large connected set of resources and we present it to the people participating in the course. And now it becomes their responsibility to define for themselves a perspective or a point of view and access into this network of connected resources. We have to, and every time we've offered a course, we've had to do this. We have to tell them, don't try to read everything. Don't try to memorize everything. Don't try to learn the content of the course. That's not how one of these courses work. And of course, 2 weeks later, there's always someone who comes back and says, you know, I just can't keep up. There's too much to read. Always. So the very first thing that they ignored was our instructions on how to participate in the course. This diagram, by the way, was not created by us. It was created by one of the participants of the course. And that's common. Here are some other interpretations of our courses. I told you there would be a donkey. Other interpretations of our courses that have been created by participants in the courses. The one in the upper left, of course, is Connectivist Duck Works. And I really don't know what to call the one that's labeled MOOC, but that is an actual representation of the course with Grasshopper and all the network and the help. So Grasshopper is, as I mentioned, the major technology we've used to offer these courses, and this is a representation of what Grasshopper does. Again, Grasshopper is really simple software. It's not complicated software at all. I wrote it. It has to be simple. And really it does basically those four things: aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. So the aggregate is input, and basically there's two ways of input: direct user input through various forms and etc., or input from external services such as blogs, Flickr, Twitter, whatever, Moodle discussions, in the form of feeds. Then that input is reorganized into a set of data elements. This set of data elements is defined inside Grasshopper, can be changed on the fly, and is extensible. And the idea long-term is that individual users would have their own data definitions. I won't go there. That's a long discussion. Then that content is reorganized, remixed into different pages. The page basically forms the heart of the Grasshopper system. And the page contains representations of the data. And then finally, the different forms of output. The email newsletters, which I create, or published as web pages, RSS feeds, etc. Any output you can imagine is how it should work. So here are the feeds in the most recent CCK 11 course. These are feeds that are created by the participants in the course. We had, by the end of the course in CCK 11, about 1,030 or so people in the course. Out of that, 179 of them, which I think is a pretty good rate, created their own RSS feed. Now, what that means is they created a blog on Blogger or on WordPress, or they tapped into a Flickr account, Tumblr, I don't know, a bunch of anything that creates an RSS feed could be a feed. And mostly, they just created one feed. So 179 feeds probably represents about 170 people. And so Grasshopper has a feed management thing there that you can see, and the Grasshopper administrator can work with each individual feed. I found that there is a fair amount of error correction to do because people still don't have a handle on getting their feed URL and putting it into a form. So that can be a lot better automated. Then Grasshopper has a built-in harvester, harvests all of the feeds. There are different ways of harvesting, and then you don't see this, but it harvests the feeds, looks at the feeds, maps them to different entity types. So some feeds come in as posts, some feeds come in as Twitter tweets, other feeds come in as events, other feeds come in as presentations. Depending on the content of the feed and the mapping parameters set by the administrator, the data is organized in different ways. Students and administrators alike can go view the input feeds in the viewer, and This is very similar. There's a, oh no, I guess it's not like that. It's basically, it's just, you know, a one page, one item, and there's little arrows. You can just page through the items. Very handy to use. And the item in the middle at the top is comment, and so that pops you right into the commenter. And so the idea here is what we're doing is giving a way for people to look at the contributions in the course very easily and then very easily, quickly be able to comment on them as well. All of this is aggregated into the course newsletter page. So here's the course newsletter page. And it's just another data form, just like the rest. I'm not very imaginative when it comes to coding like input screens, so they all look the same. Here's the page design code in more detail, and as you can see, what we do is we use a Grasshopper-specific language that grabs content out of the database, organizes it, formats it, filters it, truncates it, sorts it, and does whatever you want to it for presentation on that page. And then that page becomes the web page, the email newsletter, the RSS feed, whatever. So our experience, and I guess the blue doesn't really show up very well, one of the really rewarding things about doing a course of this nature is that we get participation from around the world, and literally around the world, because people are able to use their own environment and indeed even work in their own language. You didn't really see it there, and it doesn't come up as well in Firefox as I would like, but if you're looking at the input posts in the viewer in Chrome, Chrome has a built-in translator. So you're just paging through, and you hit something in Portuguese, and a little button pops up and says translate, and you go, sure. And then go along, and then it translates the ones in Italian. And the translations aren't perfect, but it does give you this magical ability to be bringing in content from students who are all over the world, working in different language with who knows what technology, and actually read it and understand it all in the same environment. For me, that's kind of a miraculous thing. Our experience in this environment is that contributions began fairly quickly and continued, participation and continued. This is the analysis from the Plank course, and that blue line there is the set of Twitter posts. Of course, we aggregated any tweet that used the, in this case, the Plank11 hashtag. And there was constant traffic in this course from day one to week 10 there. Our experience was that when content was contributed to the course, whether by an instructor, because we could just use Grasshopper to contribute content, or, and I did this sometimes, use my own blog, my half an hour blog to contribute content, or Flickr photos or whatever. This network of interaction, and it's actually a network of interaction, would develop around this. The trick to an environment like this, it still needs more tweaking, I would say, is to allow these connections to be drawn, to allow a participant in the course to find this thing, and create a connection between them where that connection in some way adds value to both of those two original resources. It's that creative act that immerses them in the subject that creates the kind of learning that we're attempting to accomplish in a connectivist course. So here's more of our experience, more different types of networks that are created. Here's the Plench connections to the hashtag networks. Now, some people have asked, given that there's no content and no curriculum in one of these courses, how do you assess, how do you evaluate, how do you analyze? Now, you could do it the old-fashioned way. George did that. And give them tests, which are marked, and in our Connectivist course, we did have some people who were taking the course for credit at the university. They did the traditional assignments and they were marked in the traditional way. But when your understanding of the knowledge of a discipline is such that the knowledge of a discipline is not contained in words, sentences, paragraphs, principles, formula, or equations, but rather inhabits a substructure, or might be called micro-knowledge, or a sub-symbolic type of knowledge, then you need different ways of determining whether somebody is a successful graduate of your course, or a successful practitioner of physics, or whatever. And so we get this idea of understanding whether they have learned what they're supposed to learn by their activities within this network. So this leads to the idea of big data, web of data, etc. It leads to the idea of learning analytics. But I mean, it's not learning analytics in the sense of counting page views. It's not learning analytics in the sense of how quickly did they go through the course material. It's learning analytics in a more personal sense, but in a more network-based sense. Now again, think about what we're up to here, right? We're using a network of interconnected people, one of these on the left-hand side, in order to foster or stimulate the creation of sub-symbolic knowledge in the individual composed of connections between neurons at the very basic level. There are other ways of describing it, but we'll use that for now. So that's what we're trying to evaluate, is this set of connections. The problem is it's different for every single individual. My knowledge of Paris, my knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, is literally not the same as your knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. It's going to be manifest in different ways. Learning a discipline is not like learning that Paris is the capital of France. It's like a total state. Assessing my knowledge that Paris is the capital of France means assessing all of my uses of Paris, all of my uses of France, all of my uses of capital, the ways I put these things together. If somebody said, Paris is the capital of France, and I responded, yes, that's a very good plaster. You can see how, you know, I might answer correctly on a test, Paris is the capital of France, because I've remembered that, but we know through my other activities that I don't have it yet. And so there's the totality of activities that's taking place in this network of interactions that constitutes one of our courses. It constitutes the environment beyond the course. We want to immerse people in that environment. We want people to acquire, through immersion, that nuanced knowledge, that is knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. And how do we recognize when that knowledge has been achieved? We recognize when we've got the right kind of neural state, or brain state, or cognitive state, however you want to describe it, by performance in the wider network. So there are not particular bits of knowledge, not particular competencies, but rather personal capacities as expressed through interaction in the network. So now let me come now to the PLE to wrap up. Martin said earlier, the PLE is just the device that I'm using. My iPad, my phone, etc. But the challenge is rather greater than simply having some device to access the internet. Because we need to, with our educational applications, support, integrate within, and measure the total state, that entire network. If we're just thinking of it as, you know, an iPad, the iPad doesn't do that. Moreover, we need to maintain, propagate, and continue, and for that matter, secure an identity, a base of data, from environment to environment to environment. Knowing that somebody is a physicist is not just how they behave in a course, but how they behave in Facebook, how they behave in the physicist Google group, how they behave in the physicist's second life simulations. The model where the PLE is just your device or just your browser looks a bit like this, but in that model, we get a lot of, I don't want to say duplication because it's different between Moodle and D2L and everything else, but your data, your identity, your services, etc. are contained within the individual LMSs. With the personal learning environment, we remove that personal aspect of learning from the learning management system and place it directly into the control of the user. The PLE still connects to these learning management systems, but the LMSs aren't the repository anymore of data, identity, social network, or actually most of what the LMS is now. The LMS mostly is a connection to the student information system or person or MIS, management information system, some institution-specific content and services, etc. The PLE accesses that, but leaves the rest of the content in the user's control. That way, the person's data, identity, etc. are available no matter where they are and not depending on them just being in the one environment. So we've been working on a personal learning application at the National Research Council. Obviously, it has to be more than just a device. Obviously, it has to be more than just a single application because you need robustness, you need portability, you need backup of your data should it fail, you need, well, etc. The major elements of a personal learning environment, the functionality, we've basically narrowed them down to six major components: a profiler for your personal information, the aggregator, which I've described, the editor, which is the forms and other interfaces you use to create content, scaffolds, which are portable educational applications, services such as chat, discussion area, fighting robots, etc. And then finally, six, the thing that pulls them all together is the recommender, because you have your own data, you have your own social network, your own connections, your own history, and the recommender uses your personal information in all of these services in a way no LMS ever could in order to find the best resource out there for you at this particular time in this particular place. Individual personal learning environments and individual components of a personal learning environment work in a network. The idea here is we build a network of small interconnected things. Somebody asked yesterday, how do we maintain the robustness of our applications? My answer was distribute it. We distribute the functionality across a variety of different applications and then connect them. This is basically what we've built to date, the different feeds and other services that are input, the data sets that we use, various search and recommending algorithms, the explorer, which replaces our viewer, and of course the different ways of publishing and distributing content to remote services. This is one interface model that we've designed. It wasn't very good and isn't what we're using now, but it's still the same sort of concept of different parts of the application performing these different services. Finally, what will make one of these things work? What will make one of these things work is that it most clearly satisfies the success factors for learning, knowing, reliable networks. Network democracy, as I sometimes call it. The idea that control of the network resides in the members of the network rather than some central influence. And I know that's totally contrary to the institutional way of learning. This is a very different approach to learning. I've described this under the headings of autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. Diversity. You want to encourage a variety of individuals, a variety of technologies, a variety of approaches, a variety of languages. It is through this variety that you get useful and engaging interaction. If everybody says the same thing, nobody has anything to talk about. Openness. You notice when I say how many people are in the courses, we sort of say more or less. There's no clear line between being in a course or out of a course. There's no clear line between being in a network or being out of a network. You can connect to part of a network, you can access part of a course, you can lurk, you can take part in discussions but not feeds, etc. This idea of there's an in and an out is contrary to the idea of successful network formation. Autonomy, the idea that each individual within the network is working according to their own values, their own objectives, making their own decisions, choosing for themselves what resources they want to access, what things they want to talk about, what in fact they want to study. Each individual managing their own growth their own way. And then finally, interactivity, the idea that what is learned in a network or by a network is not learned through the propagation of content or signals or information from one entity to another entity to another entity, but rather emerges through the interactions of the members of that network as a whole. And that is what comes after Moodle. Thank you for your time.